So the threat that's posed by the climate crisis is now very obviously unignorable. The polar ice caps are melting 6 times faster than they were in the 1990s. The melting in Greenland and Antarctica is tracking the worst case climate warming scenario set out by the IPCC. So without rapid cuts to carbon emissions, the analysis indicates that there actually could be a rise in sea level that would lead 400 million people exposed to coastal flooding every year by the end of this century. If emissions were stopped dead today, the ice caps would potentially continue melting for decades, and summer ice cover would likely cease by the middle of the century. The permafrost in Siberia and Canada is thawing decades earlier than initially predicted, leading to immense releases of greenhouse gases and actually God knows what else. Deforestation is accelerating in both Brazil and Africa, pushing us closer to tipping points where we'll see large areas of rainforest desertified, creating changes globally in weather patterns and removing important carbon sinks. So not only is the need for immediate action to end the fossil fuel industry clear, but also the need to reorganise society along lines that will enable us to rapidly devote humanity's capacities towards environmental rehabilitation and towards solving the problems posed by large areas of the earth becoming less habitable, by mass flooding of low-lying and densely populated regions, by decreasing ocean health, just to name a few things. An extremely radical solution is needed, comparable in its radicalism to the scale and depth of the problem we face. Due to the increasing severity of the climate disasters and the widening gap between government rhetoric, which recognises the seriousness of the issue, and government action, which aids and abets the fossil fuel industry, more young people are becoming anti-capitalist and becoming interested in revolutionary politics. And two of the political theories which seem the most radical are Marxism and anarchism. There are a million and one varieties of politics which call themselves anarchists, and for that matter, which call themselves Marxist as well. So for clarity, when I'm talking about Marxism, I'm talking about the politics of the working class organising collectively, leading a revolution, overthrowing capitalism, smashing the capitalist state, and importantly, taking political power itself as a class and reshaping society. So I'm talking about a worker state. I'm not talking about gradual reform. I'm not talking about getting into the capitalist state and using that to legislate workers into power or capitalists out of business or just presiding over a large state sector. And I'm not talking about the horrible and environmentally destructive, actually, regimes of Stalinism. Anarchism is notoriously difficult to define, and I'm actually not going to talk about the much more stupid kinds of anarchism, which also people should know are much more common, like anarcho-capitalism, where there's still a market, or more commonly, lifestyle anarchism, where you anarchistically eat out of a bin, listen to crass, and have asymmetrical hair. I'm going to focus much more on green anarchism and what people call class struggle anarchism. So usually by that, they mean some kind of anarcho-communism or anarcho-syndicalism. So these kind of anarchists, much like Marxists, also oppose capitalism, oppose the market, oppose the capitalist state. However, a point of departure is that for them, these things are symptomatic of the problem: hierarchy, authority, dominance, centralization, and power, rather than causal. The latter of those two, the kind of class struggle anarchisms, have working class struggle as an important component of their, you know, idea of how you might end capitalism, but not the working class seizing power, not the working class exercising its collective authority. The former, green anarchism, does not centre class struggle at all, is much more fucked up, but offers an analysis of the environmental crisis and a challenge to the Marxist view of history and change. So the main questions for radicals regarding the environment that we have to measure anarchism and Marxism against and see how they stack up are, first, how do we understand the crisis? So, you know, what human activity is actually destroying the planet? Who's responsible for it? How do they get away with it? The second kind of theme of questions is, how is it that we fight? What is going to be required to challenge and ultimately defeat the power responsible for this destruction? And therefore, what are the steps that we'd have to take toward that today? And then thirdly, and it really connects with the second one, what do we want instead of capitalism? What kind of world do we need to build in order to ensure the best chance of repairing what we can, of mitigating the horrible effects of the things that are now already taking place, and also of having a human society where our needs are met, where our relationship with the environment is one democratically mediated by society rather than dictated according to the profit motive. So on the first question, to understand the climate crisis, I think we have to understand the relationship between humans and nature. Humans are collective. We create societies for the purpose of surviving. We act in the world to make it more suited to our needs with conscious purpose and forethought. So this, according to Marx, made us different from all other animals. We're a part of nature, but we're a distinctive part of it. We consciously, collectively act to shape nature as well as being shaped by it as other animals are. This distinctiveness, I think, is very obvious. There's no other animal that has shaped the world as dramatically as human beings, and climate change itself is a testament to that. While some animals might be able to, you know, shape their little corner of the world, none of them could enact the kind of change that melts Antarctica, or actually more positively, that builds hospitals, develops vaccines, or consciously reforests an area of the world. So for Marx, the history of human society could only be made sense of in terms of the relationship between humans and nature. He wrote in the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts, in a physical sense, man lives only from these natural products, whether in the form of nourishment, heating, clothing, shelter. Man lives from nature. Nature is his body, and he must maintain a continuing dialogue with it if he is not to die. To say that man's physical and mental life is linked to nature simply means that nature is linked to itself. In Capital, he made it clear, though, that humans are a distinct part of nature. Humans collectively mediate the relationship between ourselves and nature via our labour. So human labour is, quote, first of all, a process between man and nature, a process by which man, through his own actions, mediates, regulates, and controls the metabolism between himself and nature. He confronts the materials of nature as a force of nature. He sets in motion the natural forces that belong to his own body, his arms, legs, head, and hands, in order to appropriate the materials of nature in a form adapted to his own needs. Through this movement, he acts upon external nature and changes it, and in this way simultaneously changes his own nature. The relationships within humanity, between humans and our labour, are integral to understanding this question too. Different societies have had very different relationships with nature, shaped by the relationship of people within society to the process of their productive labour. So there's not one kind of trans-historical, classless history of the relationship between us to nature. Of course, for Marx, history was also a history of class struggle. Primitive communist societies were democratic, with human labour democratically exercised in a collective way. Our scientific knowledge and our technological capacity were far lower than they were now. Our overall capacity to shape the world far smaller, but still, you know, shape it we did. We developed agriculture, aquaculture, etc. But with the emergence of social class, you know, one layer of people who did not labour and produce, but who dictated the labour process and controlled the fruits of production, the way that we mediated our relationship with nature changed. Pre-capitalist societies were destructive to nature, but their damage was minuscule compared with the damage wrought under capitalism. And this is because, capitalism unleashed new productive heights. As Marx and Engels commented in the manifesto, the bourgeoisie, during its rule of scarce 100 years, has created more massive and more colossal production than have all preceding generations together. Subjection of nature's forces to man, machinery, application of chemistry to industry and agriculture, steam navigation, railways, electric telegraphs, clearing of whole continents, whole populations conjured out of the ground. What earlier century had even a presentiment that such productive forces slumbered in the lap of social labour? So this has created all kinds of positives. You know, humanity now has the technical capacity to sustain billions of lives. We can cure all kinds of diseases. We have advanced our scientific understanding of the universe far further than ever before. This is an important point, I think. Unlike previous societies where environmental damage happened largely from ignorance, you know, where something like a bad harvest year could mean everyone died, capitalism is a system that has produced an abundance so large that there's no reason that anyone should ever suffer from scarcity, and scientific capacity so great that there should never be mere ignorance behind environmental devastation like the climate crisis. However, this immense productive power and scientific capacity is subordinated to the interests of the capitalist class. Capitalist production is driven by competition to accumulate. Everything is subordinate to that. All decisions about work are removed from the hands of the producers and are in the hands of the capitalists, made on the basis of competition, which drives them towards environmental destruction. So this is important because this Marxist analysis means that the culprits for climate change are one particular layer of humans, a minority within our society, due to the way that our society is organised according to the logic of capital. Their control of production is the source of this climate crisis, and it's the foundation of the power that enables them to get away with it. So the difference there for an anarchist analysis is identifying authority, hierarchy, and centralisation more generally as the problem, as opposed to the specific authority of capitalists, the hierarchy of capitalism, and the structure and logic of our current system. So I'll start with green anarchism, which comes in a few varieties, some of which are outright primitivist and anti-civilisation, the worst of which are influenced by deep ecology and biocentrism, so this view that you should kind of decentre humans from your analysis of environmental problems. So Warzone Distro, kind of publishing like online group of anarchists who counterpose their green anarchy nihilism against the left-wing position of trying to build a better world, produce a zine called What is Green Anarchy, which has been circulated at anarchist events in Australia, including at ASIN's Students of Sustainability Conference. The authors outline their view that human civilization is responsible for environmental damage and all oppression. Civilization, they say, I'll quote directly from their pamphlet, begins with and relies on the enforced renunciation of instinctual freedom. It cannot be reformed and thus is our enemy. We have a hard time understanding how one can be against all domination without getting to its roots, civilization itself. So they advocate a rejection of all human-centred thinking and the speciesism that goes along with it, so you've got to be a vegan, and claim that there's no kind of split between humans and the environment. Humans are just animals. But then weirdly kind of go on to say that the separation between humans and the environment is the base of all human ability to dominate and control other humans. So this analysis is deeply deficient. Our distinction from the rest of nature and our creation of civilization are not negatives. Perhaps one negative thing about them is they've allowed anarchists to produce this stupid thing. The problem is the power of the few, their ability to control the productive capacity of our species for destructive ends, not the undifferentiated human civilization. So this analysis cannot explain why capitalist society is more destructive than previous class societies, beyond the fact that there's more of us alive now, so it's much larger. And I think it leads to this conclusion that people having things like homes, healthcare, technology, etc., is a problem. Much worse, and I'm going to go into this more later, that large-scale democratic cooperation to seize the means of production, the technology, the scientific capacity, and harness that all for environmental ends, in this view, would be a problem rather than a solution. So the capitalist class are let off the hook as the problem is moved onto civilization as a whole. At best, they're kind of just quantitatively more destructive than workers are, rather than there actually being something qualitatively exceptional about their role. Murray Bookchin is probably the most the anarchist that's most famously associated with the environment, you know, when he was still an anarchist. He's famous for his social ecology theory and has been hugely influential on almost all anarchist environmental theory since. Unlike the nihilistic and anti-human perspective put forward by the authors of that Warzone Distro Green Anarchism zine, Bookchin, at his best, when he was an anarcho-communist, thought that a radical alternative was both necessary and possible, and he was rejected by a lot of the green anarchists on that basis. He's not against all forms of society or civilization and is for a solution involving collective participation and is very critical of capitalism. So in Post-Scarcity Anarchism, he wrote that ecologists know that a destructive parasitism usually reflects the disruption of an ecological situation. Indeed, many species that seem destructive under one set of conditions are useful under another. So what is the disruption that has turned man into a destructive parasite? What produces a form of parasitism that results not only in vast natural imbalances, but also threatens the existence of humanity? Man has produced imbalances not only in nature, but more fundamentally in his relations with fellow man and in the structure of society. The imbalances man has produced in the natural world are caused by the imbalances he has produced in the social world. So far, so good. Bookchin links ecological destruction not to the existence of humans as a parasite or society, but to the oppressive divisions within our society. So this is the basis of his anarchist social ecology. Bookchin was critical of lifestyleism and the influence of biocentrism on anarchism, believing that you actually had to put human society at the centre of your analysis of environmental crises. But in the very next line, he goes on to say, a century ago, it would have been possible to regard air pollution and water contamination as the result of self-seeking activities of industrial barons. Today, this moral explanation would be a gross oversimplification. A more serious problem than the attitude of the owners is the size of the firms themselves, their enormous proportions, their location in a particular region, their density, their requirements for raw materials, and their role in a division of labour. So the analysis, again, seems to get closer to the core problem, but focuses on a symptom and then therefore gets things asked about. The problem is that production and society are centralised and large. So Bookchin rejects capitalist control as the source of the problem, even though he thinks it's a problem, and also rejects the working class as a proposed solution because he thinks the proletariat have a stake in capitalism, which I'll come back to. So I think this is really just liberalism, seeing the problem as centralisation and power and not the specific class relations behind it. And this view connects with a long-term liberalism in anarchism. Bookchin builds on Kropotkin, whose theories around mutual aid put forward an alternative view of history against Marx's historical materialism, a struggle between hierarchy, authority, and centralisation on one hand, and the institutions of mutual aid representing freedom on the other, disconnected from class struggle. So class struggle is a feature of Kropotkin's world. He liked working class struggle, but it's just one component in a wider view of the history of all hitherto existing society being the history of mutual aid institutions versus states, with the roots of domination not necessarily being class, but instead being people's acceptance of authority and subsequent lack of self-reliance. So to get onto the kind of second theme of questions, why the fuck does any of this matter? You know, well, because the differences in your analysis of human relations to the environment and the cause of the climate crisis matter for the consequences for what you do to solve it in terms of the ultimate solution and then the steps you take today. So for revolutionary Marxists, you know, we don't think the problem is civilization, the size of our societies, or the fact that there's centralization. It's the continued rule of the capitalist class, the use of their power to structure everything in life along the lines of what is going to facilitate maximum accumulation and maximum profit. The key to the Marxist theory of change is the working class. Workers can strike, and in doing so, they can attack the source of capitalist profits. They have a shared interest in ending their oppression and exploitation. But also, the working class are structurally a collective class. Capitalism brings them into huge global networks, collective networks of production with one another. Networks between millions of workers span the whole globe, involving the labour of all of them in a complex chain. So this means they can only win the fight against their individual grievances collectively. To be victorious, their struggle has to increase in scale to cover the whole world. It has to end capitalism or none of them can be free. It has a tendency toward democracy and toward challenging oppression. And its victory as a class and its ascension to political power requires the process of democratisation and crushing capitalist power. So as a class, they have the power to challenge the capitalists, but also to establish a world that is run along democratic lines, to bring all the technology, all the science developed under capitalism, under the democratic control of society, and then reshape it according to a human logic rather than a logic of capital, reconciling human labour with collective decision-making once more. So this requires workers actually taking political power, which means a workers' state formed out of workers' democratic councils in a revolution, both in order to combat the inevitable counter-revolution of the capitalist class, but also to extend actual democracy over the totality of human labour, which I think is what's necessary to meet the challenges kind of set out to us by the situation we're facing with the climate crisis. Unlike the capitalist state, which reinforces the illegitimate authority of a minority over the majority, a worker state is one composed of workers' democratic institutions, imposing the authority of the majority, a legitimate authority, over society. the collective exercise of working class authority is the precondition, I think, for democratisation of all society. And this informs the struggle today. You know, the path that we need to take to challenge the capitalists responsible for the climate crisis is one which takes us closer to this goal. So campaigns and movements today which advance people politically, advance a kind of working class consciousness and draw them into active political participation are what Marxists favour. We're for working class struggle, we're for mass mobilisations of people and political demands which make it clear who our friends are and who our enemies are. So the tactics that we'd support at any given time are wide-ranging. You know, whether you're thinking about a protest march, a strike, a stunt, occupying some building, you know, locking yourself to some piece of mining equipment, whatever, the metric for judging any of that is its utility in taking forward class consciousness, political involvement and organisation. I think this is critical to halt the climate crisis and build a world where the relationship between humans and the environment isn't destructive and where human needs are met. You think about all the features of the climate crisis, huge deforestation, that every production of essentials, you know, food, medicine, housing, all of that is dependent in some way or another on the fossil fuel industry and on infrastructure, which assumes the continued existence of the fossil fuel industry. Rising sea levels, which aren't just going to impact the Airbnbs of the wealthy, but also hundreds of millions of the poorest people in the world. Problems like these mean that we're up against the huge power of the fossil fuel industry, but also all other capitalists. And once we finish the monumental task of defeating them, we have a situation which will require clearly the greatest feat of global cooperation which has ever occurred. We're going to need to redistribute existing resources to the world's poorest, but we're also going to have to reorganise and rebuild agriculture, transport, energy, construction globally on a whole new basis. We're going to have to use the existing global production capacity to produce the new methods and tech that we need to make all of the old shit obsolete. We'll have to dedicate ourselves to reforestation of whole areas of the world, which itself is going to pose flow-on challenges regarding food, regarding where people live. So the summary of my point here is that nothing short of global proletarian cooperation and subsuming the whole world under proletarian control will suffice to meet the challenges needed to defeat our enemy and make a climate crisis world habitable for all people. To defeat the capitalist class, we're going to have to deal with the same challenges that the working class faced in revolutionary Russia. How do you crush capitalist resistance and counter-revolution? You know, when you try and take the land back from all these fucking coal companies and farmers and put it under the control of the workers, when you try and take the Murray-Darling back from the cotton farmers, the militarised forces of the state will act to stop you. What do you do? When you've done this, the capitalists might run away to another country and come back with troops like they did in the Russian Revolution. Or a revolution might have happened somewhere else and fleeing capitalists might come to our country to get the resources they need to crush a revolution. What do you do? So the revolution, in order to finally kind of wrest control of the coal mines away from the coal bosses, will require the working class to assume political and military power in country after country until capitalism is globally conquered. That's what's necessary to defeat the capitalists and deal with the climate crisis. What do anarchists have to say about this? Well, start with the best one. No, it was the worst one. One trend in green anarchism is uncivilising. So given civilisation is the problem, you ought to uncivilise yourself. How do you uncivilise yourself? Well, you grow your own food. You stop obeying all social norms and rules, give up drugs and alcohol because that's how they civilize you, man, and also don't eat meat because that's really speciesist. Animals are our comrades. So go live on a commune right now. This totally fails to provide an answer for how to challenge capitalist power. It's individualist, it's elitist, it's useless. Nothing about the power of the state or the corporations is altered in any way if some anarchists go and live on a grotty commune, grow their own vegetables and refuse to drink any beer. This is just lifestyleism. Green Anarchy, a magazine focusing on anti-civilization primitivism with a circulation. This isn't just a peripheral thing I found. It had a circulation of about 8,000 print copies at its height. It was probably the most popular ongoing green anarchist publication in the US. In addition to nonsense like uncivilizing, they held up the Unabomber as a noble prisoner of war, publishing some of his prison writings even. And this isn't actually unique to them. Green Anarchist, which is like a similar magazine over in the UK, did the exact same thing. So for people who don't know, the Unabomber was a primitivist anarchist who committed a decades-long campaign of detonating bombs in universities, computer stores, airplanes, and the homes of timber company lobbyists. So while blowing up a timber lobbyist might not actually seem like a very bad crime when you compare it to the crimes committed by the timber industry, it's a political tactic which would never actually challenge logging, and much less would maiming some computer science professor. Like, that's actually just supremely despicable. Bookchin famously critiqued the kind of lifestyle anarchism and individualist actions that green anarchism promotes, but he also can't offer a solution for how to challenge capitalist power. Even in his early anarchist writing, Bookchin is clear on his disagreement with the Marxist view that workers' revolution is possible or desirable as a means of challenging capital and establishing a new world. He wrote that the proletariat, like its plebeian counterpart in the ancient world, shares actively in a system that sees its greatest threat from a diffuse populace of intellectuals, urban dwellers, feminists, gays, environmentalists. In short, a trans-class people that still expresses the utopian ideals of democratic revolutions long past. Elsewhere, he argued that his experience in the workers' movement, which was actually quite extensive, he was an organiser, led him to conclude that the workers' movement never really had any revolutionary potential. The factory, which is supposed to organise the workers, in Marxist language, mobilise them, instil in them the class consciousness that is to stem out of the conflict between wage labour and capital, has in fact developed habits of mind of the worker that serve to regiment the worker, that serve to assimilate the worker to the work ethic, to the industrial routine, to hierarchical forms of organisation. And no matter how compellingly Marx had argued that such a movement could have revolutionary consequences, in fact, such a movement can have nothing but a purely adaptive function, an adjunct to the capitalist system itself. So Bookchin completely rejects the revolutionary role of the working class. He saw the utility in winning over parts of the proletariat to the environment movement, even their potential participation in a revolution, but as citizens or feminists or gay people rather than as industrial workers. He rejected a worker-led revolution as a means to challenge capital. And part of this rejection is due to the kind of society Bookchin wanted to see, a scaled-down, decentralised series of municipalities rather than a global democratisation of labour and production. This is a point I'll revisit. The alternative diffuse populace he looked to had no comparable social power to that of the proletariat. It also lacked the characteristics which make the working class an inherently collective class with that capacity for mass democratisation. So Bookchin's ideas have been extremely influential on most eco-anarchist thought, and they dovetail well with the rejection of the working class as the agent of change from anarchists like Proudhon, Kropotkin and Bakunin, and also the long-time anarchist fascination with the village, the commune and peasant pre-capitalist rural life. This is one reason that I actually don't think the lifestyle anarchism, which features prominently in the anarchist tradition, is something you could write off as inconsequential idiots who just haven't taken the theory seriously enough. If the problem is not fundamentally capitalist control, well, that's just a symptom. If we've got to decentralise, regress to pre-capitalist forms of production, live in smaller communities, you know, where we all know each other and play a direct part in producing each thing that's necessary to keep us alive, and if the working class is not the agent of social change, then today it does make sense to build a commune, go camping, you know, learn to forage, learn to go rock climbing, whatever. All of this prefigures the world you want to see. It opts yourself out of all the nasties of capitalism and helps you reconnect your individual self with, you know, your labour and your nature. It's, of course, very silly. It offers no strategy for challenging capitalist power or democratising that mediation of our relationship with nature. It also connects with another of the popular anarchist strategies for challenging environmental destruction, which is direct action. It's an often misunderstood term, and anarchist Dave Graeber, when he was kind of explaining what it was, said, like, as opposed to, like, civil disobedience, where there's a war on and you burn your draft card, that's withdrawing consent from an authority that you deem illegitimate, but it's also recognising that authority by protesting against it. Direct action is one step further. So rather than protesting against the authority and therefore kind of recognising its legitimacy in some way, you act as if the authority is not there and start to build the world that you want yourself. So if a company has a legal right and authority to go do logging, act as if they don't. They're just people. You're just a person. No party has any particular special authority. So go sit in front of that logging truck. Lock yourself onto mining equipment. Suspend yourself over a train line to prevent the transportation of coal. So don't appeal to the state or the company for change. The people should act as if they have the power. Then they'll actually have it because they're taking matters into their own hands. So direct action is a staple of the anarchist movement, the anarchist environmental action, rather. From the anarchists involved in Earth First in the United States, using tree spiking, climbing and occupying trees, blockading trucks, to today, where there's calls from anarchists for a movement of similar tactics to defeat the Adani coal mine or whatever it's rebranded itself as now, Brabus or something. So a group of self-styled anarcho-communists in Melbourne have published an argument to this effect, calling on people to actually stop Adani themselves via direct action, which will challenge the state, their words, by causing the state to send police to brutalise the participants, thus discrediting it in the eyes of the masses, and that will be the spark that lights off further resistance. So Marxists might support direct action if it would be the most useful thing in that moment. I'm not against some of the actions that I kind of described. You know, perhaps if you time it to coincide with a mass protest and it advertises it, or it's something that actually a whole lot of people are collectively involved in together, it actually might be quite good. But for anarchists, it's elevated far beyond that, because for them it's a prefiguration of their ideal world and a rejection of power. There's a few problems, though. Usually these blockading efforts are a small group of people standing in as a substitute for the mass of people. The mass get to watch the spectacle and maybe be radicalised by it. So the elitism of anarchism is on show there. You look away from the working class, you know, even if you kind of recognise its struggle and some of its power, anarchism rejects that Marxist view of its role in creating a new world. So the enlightened minority of anarchists play the role by being the lightning rod that shocks the masses out of their inactive stupidity. So Emma Goldman, who is my second least favourite anarchist, expresses it best. She wrote, "Always, at every period, the few were the banner bearers of a great idea, of a liberating effort. Not so the mass, the leaden weight of which does not let it move. The majority cares little for ideals and integrity. What it craves is a display. It does not matter whether that is a dog show, a prize fight, or a lynching. The living vital truth of social and economic well-being will become a reality only through the zeal, courage, and non-compromising determination of intelligent minorities, not through the mass." Disgusting. So the fetishisation of direct action, I think, links with anarchist misunderstandings of capitalism and power and a misunderstanding of an obsession with the state. So for anarchism, the state is more than just, you know, the source of the problem than capital. You know, before the existence of capital, after all, there was the state. There was the dominating authoritarian body which placed limits on human freedom. And there's a problem with looking at it this way, abstracted from class. The capitalist state developed alongside capital. It exists to help secure the best conditions for the capitalists. The capitalists use it, but it isn't the source from which their power springs. So, yes, it is positive if people lose faith in the police or, you know, see the authority of the capitalist state as illegitimate, but these things don't challenge power or the power of capital, and in and of themselves they actually don't challenge the state either. So to stop the fossil fuel industry in Australia and to stop the state from backing it, I think it would be necessary to have a situation of revolution, of revolt. Given the centrality of fossil fuel exports in the Australian economy, you'd have to make Australia ungovernable. This would have to culminate in the working class removal of capitalists from power by seizing all their infrastructure, overthrowing the capitalist state, and having workers' councils assume state power. So direct action in itself won't cut it by just prefiguring the world we want to see. And this feeds in, I think, to that third kind of theme of questions about what kind of world we actually need to fix the climate crisis. And I think a commonality between different anarchist views of the future is decentralisation and, frankly, regression. Anti-civilisation, green anarchism, is the most regressive. We should have a world where no society exists that requires any resource inputs from somewhere else. So this obviously means things like medicine, you know, my glasses, you know, wheelchairs, specialised nutrition, whatever, are out. So aside from the horrible moral implications of the mass suffering and death this would cause, and of course suspending our disbelief regarding the absence of a workers' revolution and workers' power, A post-capitalist green anarchist society of this model has no means of dealing with the future mass coastal flooding, no means of dealing with further carbon emissions, the kind of feedback loops regarding like continuing melting of ice or permafrost, whatever. It's a joke solution. And I think these anti-civilization green anarchists probably would find a lot in common with paleo nutcase Pete Evans. On the solution put forward by Pukchin, he and those inspired by him don't reject technology and civilization like the primitivists do. But he's still for a decentralized series of municipalities, which will be both the means and the end. So for Pukchin, these municipalities were thought of as a new political sphere, whereby an active citizenry and their popular assemblies ultimately develops into a counterpower standing opposed to the nation state. So half of that sort of sounds a bit like XR. This will be more democratic and less authoritarian by virtue of being smaller and more local, which enables participants to have a democratic say over all their activities. This also doesn't challenge the power of the state or capital. Again, suspending our disbelief regarding the absence of the industrial power of the working class, how do local decision-making assemblies coordinate resistance to capitalist counter-revolution? How do they combat invasion like that faced by the Russian working class after the revolution? And importantly for our purposes regarding the climate crisis, how is it that they coordinate and enforce global shutdown of the fossil fuel industry, a transition away from plastics globally? How do they coordinate global food production? Because it now is global, you have to coordinate that. If everyone's just growing their own capsicums, a bunch of people fucking starve to death. How do they coordinate the distribution and production of many other technological and medical essentials, which are only produced globally? Even so-called class struggle anarchism, like anarcho-syndicalism and anarcho-communism, which see the working class as part of achieving change and which might advocate for a working class revolution, fail on the questions of overthrowing capitalist power, the power of the fossil fuel capitalists, and creating a new world. These kind of anarchisms, I think, are more left-wing because they focus on the class with the social power to fight the capitalists, but there's still an opposition to this class ruling. So what does this mean? Well, for anarchists, this means that they're anti-authoritarian. You know, rather than the Stalinist dictatorship model, they're against the state as authoritarian. And actually, though, often they're still for a decentralized localist model. But they're always against the idea of a workers' state. You know, the actual act of workers' final victory in class struggle, their assumption of power and their democratisation of human activity, human capacity at a global level to solve the climate crisis, that's antithetical to anarchism. Judy Barry is probably one of the most famous kind of anarchists who was involved in environmental campaigning but also had a working class focus. So she was a lifelong unionist. She joined Earth First at a time when the leading kind of, they were leading an anti-logging campaign, and it was full of like America's leading green anarchists. One of their tactics was to drive metal spikes into trees with the goal of damaging the saws that was used to fell those trees. So this resulted in one worker being almost decapitated when a 12-foot section of the saw blade he was using hit one of these nails, broke off, sliced through his face and throat, ripped straight through his face mask and cut through his jugular vein. His jaw was broken in five places, 12 of his teeth were instantly knocked out, and the blade actually wrapped around his body. So his co-workers had to try and hold his neck shut while they were blowtorching the blade off of him to stop him from bleeding to death. So Barry got her section of Earth First to break with the rest of Earth First and condemn this practice as anti-worker. She tried to reach out to the logging workers and put a case against the company. She saw them as potential allies of the environmentalists and vice versa. And in her essay on revolutionary ecology, she wrote that a revolutionary ideology in the hands of privileged people can bring about disruption and some change in the system. But a revolutionary ideology in the hands of working people can bring that system to a halt. For it is the working people who have their hands on the machinery, and only by stopping the machinery of destruction can we ever hope to stop this madness. It's only when the factory workers refuse to make the toxins, only when the loggers refuse to cut the ancient trees, that we can ever hope for real and lasting change. This system cannot be stopped by force. It's violent and ruthless beyond the capacity of any people's resistance movement. The only way I can even imagine stopping it is through mass non-cooperation. But workers' ceasing participation is not enough. Unless we want a primitivist solution, the work that happens, the production that exists, needs to be put under the control of the working class. And this can't happen without the missing ingredient in Barry's analysis, working class confrontation with capital and the state, and their victory in that confrontation via the formulation and utilisation of a workers' state. The syndicalist solution of mass general strikes falls into this hole as well. You know, there have been quite a lot of general strikes in history, not as much as I would like. I'd love there to be many more, but they have not overthrown capitalism. In and of themselves, they're not actually enough to put control in the hands of the workers. The class struggle kind of anarchist support for the working class, I think, there is revealed as pretty liberal. The class content of capitalist rule is stripped away, and the heart of Marxism, the final triumph of the working class, is rejected. So it's like being for working class struggle so long as they don't win. This seems odd if anarchism is supposed to be radical anti-authoritarianism. You know, surely it means that it's radically democratic and would therefore be in favour of the most extreme form of democracy. But that's wrong. The rejection of all authority, the rejection of, you know, central coordination and rejection of workers' state, a rejection of any kind of imposition of the, of anything against the absolute freedom of the individual, all of this results in opposition to mass democracy. So anarchist historian George Woodcock explained it really well in his History of Anarchism, where he wrote that no conception of anarchism is further from the truth than that which regards it as an extreme form of democracy. Democracy advocates sovereignty of the people. Anarchism advocates sovereignty of the person. Parliamentary institutions are rejected because they mean that the individual abdicates his sovereignty. This is why anarchists regard voting as the act that betrays freedom. But the anarchist opposition to democracy goes deeper than dispute over forms. It involves a rejection of the idea of the people as an entity distinct from the individuals who compose it. It also involves a denial of popular government. Particularly, the anarchist rejects the right of the majority to inflict its will on the minority. Democracy is the imposition of an authority. A worker state is the authority of the working class imposed on society. And these things are positive. And, the antithesis of the minority authority of the capitalist class that's destroying our environment. But from the days of Bakunin's characterization of Marxist communism as state communism, to the rejection of workers' power in the Russian Revolution, to today's obsessions with localism and direct action, the rejection of the possibility of the democratisation of society is the connecting thread that runs through anarchism. This is the connection between the seemingly disparate themes of the fetishisation of direct action, of obsession with localism, of the idealisation of rural life, of lifestyleism, of the elitist conception of the masses, the anti-civilisation, you know, the dreams of fully automated, luxury, federated space municipalities, a rejection of the possibility or desirability of mass democracy imposed by the working class, fought for against the capitalist class as the basis of communist society, is at the heart of that. So anarchism fails. It fails on why there's a climate crisis. It fails on how we struggle today. It fails on the power that we would need to combat this system. And it fails on what kind of world we want to solve the climate crisis. But to conclude, I have a bit of a confession. This has been a bit dishonest because I want people to understand that anarchism is actually far, far worse than what I have said. I've given a very, very artificially good picture of anarchism because I have spent the last 3 months combing through an ocean of crap to find a single coherent perspective. None of what I've said does justice to anarchism, and I mean it in the negative sense. Yeah. There's heaps of anarchist perspectives online that seem better, you know, anarcho-green communism, green syndicalism, etc. None of it is matched in the real world by any meaningful organisation that I'm aware of. They're just brain farts of someone online and then found five other people online that like it. The key thing we need is workers' power. We need a workers' state, we need mass democratisation and the reuniting of production and decision-making on a global scale to save the planet. Anarchism is opposed to all of it. So in the realm of theory, you know, in the distant future, anarchism is deficient, but it is better there than what it looks like today in environmental campaigning in Australia. What it looks like is largely a bunch of people who go camping together and who make pretty right-wing interventions into climate campaigns from my observations. So anarchism cannot equip us with the politics to challenge the capitalist, to smash the state, or have a democratised world which turns its capacities towards ensuring human survival in the climate crisis and transitioning our world to be green. So if you had any kind of illusions in anarchism, junk that and be a Marxist if you want a solution to the climate crisis.